want to welcome you. My name's Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. On behalf of our senatorial leadership, Susan Collins and Jay Rockefeller, and our board of directors, welcome to this program on the interaction between Medicaid and our current economic slowdown. Our partner in today's program is the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, which is a project of the Kaiser Family Foundation, one of the most respected policy voices in reform debate and discussions of other policy issues involving health care. You'll hear from Diane Rowland from the Commission and the Foundation in just a moment. Medicaid's a counter-cyclical program. Now, I'm married to a Harvard-trained economist. I know what counter-cyclical means. I guess I'm lucky. Simply put, when the economy goes down, the demand on the Medicaid program goes up. Throw in the fact that states are, by and large, required by their constitutions to balance their budgets, and you have some real dissonance to deal with. While state and federal spending on Medicaid should be going up to cope with the larger numbers of people needing help with their health care when they lose their jobs, governors and legislators are forced to reduce spending on Medicaid and everything else, particularly since Medicaid is such a large proportion of most states' budgets. I should add that both Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins have taken a special interest in this topic. During the last economic slowdown in 2003, they were leaders in putting in place legislation giving states a temporary increase in the percentage of Medicaid costs covered by the federal government. I will use the dreaded acronym FMAP, which you may hear a few times before we finish, to help states get past that rough patch. And similar legislation, as many of you know, is under consideration right now, perhaps as part of the economic stimulus package that's the top priority of Congress and of President-elect Obama. Now, today we get a chance to look at that experience back in 2003 and 2004, see what's happening today in the states, and what the consequences might be of federal action or inaction in this area. I particularly commend to you several new publications from Kaiser on different aspects of this problem. There were a couple of them in your packets. There's one that you should have picked up in a stack as you came in. If you didn't get them, I commend them to you, and you really ought to get hold of them. They are up to date. They are accessible, and they are a valuable source of information. And that, of course, brings me back to the observation that we are co-hosting today's briefing with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. They've done a great deal of work on this issue beyond the new publications that you have. And here to represent the Commission and the Foundation and sharing moderator duties is one of the country's top policy analysts in the field of health. She is the Executive Vice President of the Foundation, Director of the Commission, Diane Rowland. Diane?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you all for being here. It is once again a time when we gather to talk about an economic downturn, a recession, and its implications for health care for some of the lowest income Americans, as well as for state economies and the ability of states to cope with it. And perhaps most striking today, we heard that the jobless rate has now risen to 7.2%, with a loss of over 500,000 more jobs in December. So we know that family budgets are being strained, that health care and access to health care for many families is in jeopardy, both with their loss of insurance and with their diminished income to be able to pay for any care that they need. So more and more folks, as Ed said, are turning to Medicaid just at a time when the state revenues are least able to cover the increasing costs. So the briefing that we've put forth today really will try and set up a discussion for you of where Medicaid fits in the economic downturn, how Medicaid can be part of an economic stimulus. And I think to start, it's important for us to remember what Medicaid is as a program. And I know many of you may be newly joining us for these Alliance briefings, where we try and lay out the facts and then engage with you in a discussion. And so the first slide that we have, I'll have Robin just do it. Robin, you can just do it. Is really what we call the kind of Medicaid overview. And it reminds us of all the different roles that Medicaid plays today. Too often we think of the program mainly in terms of its role in providing health insurance coverage to children and some of their parents. And indeed it does that. Today it covers 1 in 4 of America's children for their health insurance coverage. And it, with the complementary program, SCHIP is really the main provider of health care services to children under 200% of poverty, our low-income population. But it also is a gap filler for the Medicare program, helping low-income Medicare beneficiaries with their premiums and cost sharing. Also a time when the elderly and the people with disabilities need more assistance and turn to Medicaid for help, as well as the only source of public assistance for long-term care expenditures, which are a major source of financial burden for many families with children with disabilities, as well as the elderly and people with disabilities. It is a primary factor in the way in which we pay for healthcare services in the U.S., and I'll show you in a moment how that works, and also, obviously, the major source of federal assistance to the states in terms of helping them meet the healthcare needs of their population. In terms of its role in the healthcare economy, when we look at Medicaid and the healthcare system, it now pays for about 16% of all healthcare services and supplies used for personal healthcare. So it is a major purchaser in the healthcare market, but also as a major payer, supporting the healthcare workforce, supporting healthcare expenditures, accounting for 17% of hospital care, 42% of nursing home care, and 8% of overall prescription drug purchases. So when we think about cutting back Medicaid, we're not just cutting back on eligibility and coverage for low-income people who have Medicaid as their source of coverage. We're also reducing the income and the ability to pay for services in the healthcare sector more broadly. But when we think about who Medicaid covers, it's important to remember that while the face of the program may be low-income children, they account for half of the beneficiaries, the large bulk of expenditures this program spends its dollars on are for assistance to the elderly and people with disabilities, so that when we look at expanding eligibility or improving coverage for the low-income population, for children and their parents, they are not the main cost driver in terms of Medicaid expenditures. Which finally brings us to a reality that we have to deal with, especially as more people turn to Medicaid eligibility and try and qualify for the program, that the way eligibility standards have worked is that mostly eligibility is at higher income levels for low-income children and at very low levels of eligibility for a threshold for those who are elderly and disabled and for working parents. And in fact, today, unless a state can get a waiver from the federal government, childless adults, no matter how poor, are ineligible for the Medicaid program. So in this economic downturn, as more people turn to the Medicaid program, there is broad access for children at income levels at 200% of poverty or sometimes higher, which is about $40,000 for a family of four, but very limited access for the adults who are losing their jobs and losing their coverage, which is why we see renewed pressure on the program. And with that, we'll turn to Ed to begin the panel discussion.
Thank you very much, Diane. Good scene setting. And we're going to lead off the discussion. And let me just say, we apologize for the acoustics in this room. It's a beautiful room, but it's almost impossible to hear in. So I ask each of our speakers to be as distinct as they possibly can. And when you get to the point of asking questions at the microphones, do the same thing. Let me lead off today then with Robin Rudowitz, who's a principal policy analyst for the Kaiser Commission, where she's been doing and overseeing a lot of analysis on Medicaid and low-income people's health care coverage for the last several years. She's been a senior manager at the Lewin Group. She's served stints both at CMS's Office of Legislation and at CBO. And Robin's here to give us a grasp of the basics of the interaction between Medicaid and the economy. Robin, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Ed and Diane. And I am going to start off exactly what Ed said with a brief overview of Medicaid and the economy. We all know in this room quite well that the current economic situation is quite severe. There were 44 states either facing or facing current budget shortfalls in fiscal year 2009 or 2010. This includes 30 states that had budget shortfalls as they were heading into their fiscal 2009 year of about $48 billion. Those states and budget shortfalls had to be addressed, but now there are 41 states facing mid-year budget gaps of about $42 billion. And 38 states are already projecting budget shortfalls for fiscal 2010 that could total $145 billion. State revenues are falling short. Unemployment is rising, as Diane mentioned. Just as of this morning, we heard that the unemployment rate is now 7.2%. 2.5 million jobs lost over the last year and over 500,000 in the last month. The situation is always particularly difficult for states, as Ed mentioned, because they need to balance their budgets annually, and they must use their reserves or raise taxes or cut spending to meet those requirements. Looking backwards, states are really just recovering from the last economic downturn that lasted from 2001 to 2004. During that time, Medicaid enrollment and spending growth peaked in 2002 at the same time that revenues were dropped sharply. States all adopted an array of cost containment strategies to control Medicaid spending growth. All states across the country implemented some provider rate cuts or freezes. All states also implemented actions to rein in spending on prescription drugs, and fewer states also adopted policies to restrict benefits or cut eligibility at that time. To help states, Congress did enact legislation to provide temporary fiscal relief. Half of it was in the form of block grants to states, and another half was in the form of an increased FMAP for states. All states received a 3%, or about a 3% increase in the match rate that would increase the federal share of Medicaid costs. That lasted for 15 months from May 2003 to June 2004 on the conditions, really, that states maintain their eligibility levels for Medicaid. That fiscal relief proved to be a successful strategy in helping states to both close Medicaid budget shortfalls and general fund shortfalls, and really avoid deeper cuts for the Medicaid programs than otherwise would have taken place. One criticism of that relief was that it really came too late into the economic downturn after states had already made such significant program cuts. In addition to providing health coverage, Medicaid and the CHIP program as well both serve as important economic engines in state economies. Funding from these programs supports jobs and incomes, both within the healthcare sector and across other sectors of the economy and states through the multiplier effect of that spending. Medicaid's economic impact is intensified because of the federal matching dollars that follow the program. The same is true for CHIP, although there are smaller amounts of dollars in that program, but the match rate is higher, so it's intensified even further. On one hand, when states spend money on these programs, they receive additional dollars from the federal government. On the other hand, when they cut spending for these programs, they lose federal matching dollars. Just as an example, a state with a 60% match rate really needs to cut total Medicaid spending by $2.40 to save just $1 in state Medicaid funding. And cutting these programs during an economic downturn really exacerbates and can worsen the economic situation for states. When we conducted our annual Medicaid budget survey over the summer, just as states were starting their fiscal year 2009, they were already anticipating effects of the economic downturn. They projected that Medicaid spending and enrollment growth was projected to increase. When state legislators finalized their budgets for 2009, they authorized spending growth at 5.8% on average, higher than 2008. Even at that time, however, most Medicaid directors, two out of three of them, said that they anticipated that that level of appropriations was not going to be adequate for fiscal 2009. We were able to get back in touch with the Medicaid directors in November and December, and even a few months into the fiscal year, it was clear that the economic downturn was affecting states across the country, although there was quite a bit of variation in the impact of the downturn. Over half of the Medicaid directors, 30 states and the District of Columbia, reported that spending and enrollment growth was already exceeding the levels that they had projected over the summer, in some cases by a lot, by a substantial margin. In many cases, the states with the worst economic situation were seeing the largest enrollment increases. There's one example I can point to in Nevada. They are experiencing some of the highest unemployment rates, large budget shortfalls, and substantial revenue declines. They've had to make three rounds of budget cuts to their program, including Medicaid cuts, and they're at the same time facing double-digit growth in their enrollment. Many states are also facing the prospect of mid-year cutbacks in fiscal 2009, and they're expecting that the program, the issues could be worse in 2010. Directors are really finding it difficult to identify options, especially after they were so aggressive in adopting cost control measures in the last economic downturn. A lot of what we would call the low-hanging fruit in terms of just getting efficiencies out of the program have already been adopted, and new cuts may really hit the core of programs. Medicaid directors are really thinking that the priority for Congress in action is to adopt some type of enhanced Medicaid FMAP, as well as the reauthorization of the CHIP program and withdrawal of some of the federal Medicaid regulations that could shift additional costs to the states. Research shows us that for every 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate, employer coverage declines and Medicaid and CHIP rolls increase by about 1 million people, and the uninsured increases by about 1.1 million. So we know if the unemployment rate went from 4.9% last December to 7.2%, we would expect to see an additional 2.5 million uninsured people. These increases result in additional Medicaid spending at the state level, as well as additional pressures to fund uncompensated care costs. At the same time, unemployment increases result in state revenue losses, which puts pressure to cut program spending across the board, and including Medicaid. We also recently conducted focus groups with families in 5 different cities across the country, and we found that families are really being hard hit by the economy. Individuals with seemingly secure jobs were laid off, and despite aggressive attempts, have been unable to find new jobs. Families are really struggling to pay their rent or their mortgage, to buy groceries, pay utilities, and, of course, health care. Individuals lost their jobs and their employer health coverage, and they really can't afford to purchase the COBRA that they're offered, and some don't even qualify for COBRA and certainly cannot afford other non-group coverage. Those receiving unemployment benefits often were disqualified from Medicaid coverage because of the value of those benefits. As a result, many are uninsured and are not getting the health care that they need, and in many cases, this has serious consequences. Individuals aren't getting insulin, hypertension medication, asthma meds, et cetera. So with no other alternative, many are really turning to public assistance for the first time. Those who enroll in Medicaid have had a lot of success in getting critical access to care, particularly for children. However, better outreach and easier application processes and broader coverage options for adults would really help families that are in need. Congress is currently considering and debating the components of a fiscal stimulus bill. Some of the options to help bolster Medicaid at this time of really increased need include certainly direct funding support for the Medicaid program. There's been a lot of discussion and debate about the enhanced FMAP, and I think there are still ongoing discussions about how much the level of that assistance, how long it should last, how that funding is going to be distributed across the states, and the conditions that states will need to meet to receive that funding. Some other options to help bolster the program in terms of financing would be to shift some expenses, some Medicare expenses, to the federal government, and again to rescind those regulations that might shift additional costs to the states. I think states are also anxious for the reauthorization of the CHIP program, which would bring stable and predictable financing as well as additional dollars to support children's coverage. To help those in need, it would also be helpful for policymakers to look at ways to improve eligibility and to simplify outreach, and along those same lines, to mitigate those burdens that are associated with the citizenship and identity documentation rules that were imposed by the DRA. And finally, policymakers are looking at expansions to Medicaid to help additional populations that are hit by the recession.
Good. Thank you very much, Robin. With that as a very fine background, now we're going to hear from several folks who have firsthand experience with Medicaid and the people it serves in these difficult times. And we're going to start with David Perella, who runs the Medicaid program in Connecticut. More formally, he's the Director of Medical Care Assistance in the state's Department of Social Services. He's twice chaired the National Association of Medicaid Directors and has more than two decades of service in state government. And if I only hand him the clicker, he'll be able to move his slides.
Well, actually, I don't have any slides today.
Well,
we're going to do this old school. Good afternoon, everybody. As the person who's currently the longest-serving Medicaid director in the country, I come to you today with a perspective that's been shaped by the trials of earlier recessions and their economic impact on Medicaid going back into the 1980s. There's certainly similarities to previous recessions. Connecticut, my state, is in many ways as much a part of the tri-state area around New York City as it is part of New England. Like New York and New Jersey, close to 30% of the revenue that goes to our general fund is generated by income and capital gains that's derived from activity on Wall Street. When the street's doing well, we do well. In three out of the last 4 years, Connecticut enjoyed record budget surpluses driven by a bull market on Wall Street. But just as in 2001, when the World Trade Center came down, these revenues have not tapered off. They have stopped. No state budget, with the ongoing obligations for health care, education, and public safety, can adjust that quickly to such a massive disruption in an economic sector that accounts for such a significant portion of its revenue base. That's why now, as in 2001, we are facing record deficits larger than 2001 on the order of $6.5 billion for the coming biennium. That may seem small in comparison to the prodigious numbers coming out of California and New York, but that's close to 20% of our total general fund. And Medicaid alone is going to be expected to make up $1 billion of that. But that having been said, there is something about this recession that feels dramatically different from downturns that preceded it. Yes, it is similar to the others in that Medicaid and food stamp caseloads are rising dramatically just when revenues to support those programs are declining. The 6% increase in Medicaid caseload we've experienced in the past 12 months is probably just the harbinger of things to come. But what makes this seem so different is that the bad news came so suddenly after a long period of economic growth that spurred our state, like many states, to seriously contemplate measures to close the final gaps in health care coverage. We started from a very advantageous position. In 2007, only 9% of our residents were uninsured, and we had not experienced the decline in commercial coverage that's been so well documented in other states. Following the 2007 session of the General Assembly, Governor Rell launched her Charter Oak program, which now provides state-subsidized coverage to 4,000 previously uninsured single adults at premiums, with premium assistance up to 300% of the federal poverty. We expanded Medicaid coverage for the parents of children covered under our Husky program with incomes up to 185% of poverty and pregnant women up to 250% of poverty. Realizing that coverage isn't enough if you don't have access, we increased provider rates for hospitals, dentists, and doctors. We shifted our delivery model for behavioral health and dental care from at-risk administration to non-risk contracting to increase utilization. We carved pharmacy out of managed care to maintain one consistent preferred drug list across all our programs, and we rebid all our managed care contracts with strict guidelines for transparency. We soon will implement a primary care case management pilot to see if that further enhances the practice of a medical home model for primary care. All these measures were undertaken as part of a rising tide of expectation for access and for quality. And now this. In my state, health policy enthusiasts can scarcely acknowledge that many of the gains we've achieved over the past few years will be difficult, if not impossible, to maintain without a renewed emphasis on cost reduction. Many of us who question the wisdom of the cost-sharing and benefit package options enacted as part of the Deficit Reduction Act may be forced to find ourselves implementing them as an alternative to outright reductions in Medicaid eligibility. Groups that pay premiums now, such as the households with children enrolled in our SCHIP program, can probably look forward to much higher premiums in the future. What can the federal government do to help out not just Connecticut, but all the states? There's short-term and long-term answers. The National Association of State Medicaid Directors has identified an agenda for the first 30 days and for the months that follow that could address some of the immediate and longer-term impacts of the recession. In the short term, everyone acknowledges step one would be to provide immediate financial relief to the states in the form of enhanced Medicaid match rates. I would add that that enhanced rate needs to be sustained for a period of 24 months because Medicaid lags recovery in the rest of the economy. Number two, and reauthorization of the SCHIP program, with adequate funding to address the needs of the states that are chronically underfunded. And as part of that, the repeal of the August 17th letter that imposed limits on the flexibility of the states to use their SCHIP funds to cover children with incomes above 200%. States should also be allowed to use funds to purchase family coverage, which would include adults. Easing of the documentation for citizenship requirements that were imposed on the DRA. These requirements, particularly now during our hardship, are actually keeping eligible Americans off the Medicaid rolls and in some cases forcing states to state fund their care when federal match should rightly be available. Suspend the collection of clawback from the states to fund Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D was unique in my experience where states were asked to pay for the expansion of a Medicare benefit that rightly should have been part of the Medicare benefit all along. In recent years, state contributions have not been adjusted to reflect savings realized in Medicare in the administration of the program, which only makes contributions at the current level more galling. In order to incentivize states to aggressively pursue program integrity, CMS needs to rethink the whole PERM process and immediately rescind the requirement that states must refund the federal share of Medicaid within 60 days of an audit finding, regardless as to whether they've actually recovered the dollars. In most cases, they haven't. Immediately take action to repeal the six CMS regulations that are currently under moratorium until April 1, 2009. These regulations include regulations on provider taxes, rehabilitative services, targeted case management, school-based administration and transportation, public provider cost limits, and graduate medical education. A substantial portion of the Medicaid budget that the states are struggling to sustain goes to provide care for persons who are already covered by another federal health care program, namely Medicare. We need to look at ways that the federal government could start to buy out at least some of the health care obligations borne by the states for the dual eligibles. At a minimum, that means a broader sharing of Medicare data on the duals with the states so that the states and the federal government can work together to contain costs and improve outcomes. A more ambitious goal would be to eliminate the 24-month waiting period for Medicare for SSI recipients. I hope that the new administration will be open to restoring a productive state-federal partnership. Medicaid has an important role to play, not only in the financing of health care as an entitlement program, but as part of a larger strategy for health reform. This cannot succeed in the atmosphere of distrust that has unfortunately characterized the relationship between CMS and the states during the recent past. Medicaid is boots on the ground in this recession. In any larger discussion of health care reform, Medicaid will inevitably play a crucial role, whatever the outcome is. Thanks.
Thanks very much, David. Next, we're going to hear from Stan Rosenstein. For the last 22 years, Stan has worked with the California version of Medicaid called Medi-Cal, many of those years as its director. David talked about the prodigious numbers in the California program. How about these? It covers 7 million people and had a budget last year of $37 billion. Prodigious indeed. And Stan has been managing that for a lot longer than the average tenure of a Medicaid director, which is something like 18 months. So he's has been head of one of the largest health plans of any kind in this country, and he's just joined Health Management Associates, which is one of the most highly respected policy consulting firms in the country. So we're very pleased to be able to catch you on the East Coast. Stan?
Good afternoon. I think I'm in day four of my new career, so it's very interesting having just left the state. I'm happy to be here. Let's see if I can work the... let me talk a little about California's budget situation. I think if people compare California, if it was a country, it would be the sixth largest economy in the world. So obviously it's a big part of the economy in the world, a big part of the economy in the United States. California never came out of the last budget recession in terms of the state budget. A lot of states have seen a recovery and then has done very well. California never got its budget balanced for a lot of, a lot of reasons, which I won't belabor. But because of that, California has been in an environment of cutting the budget now for about 4 years straight, where every year there's no real add-ons. It's a reduction in the budget. California was probably the leader in the collapse of the housing market. We saw it first. You can drive through neighborhoods throughout California and see foreclosure signs everywhere. We were very much affected by the stock market. We're highly dependent on income tax, and if you're dependent on income tax, you're dependent on capital gains or the lack of capital gains. We are, I think, the third largest unemployment rate in the nation now, and the only good segment of the economy, and that's starting to show trouble, is healthcare. So what we're talking about today is really protecting and enhancing the most vibrant part of the economy, at least in the state of California. California has had continuing deficits, and what's happened this year, which is unprecedented, is the state general fund revenue declined by nearly 15%, a little bit over $15 billion. And that's between an expenditure estimate was done in July and today, 14.7%. Revenue decrease and workload just in the current year, a cost went up by $1.5 billion. So you've got a situation where revenue is falling at levels that has never fallen before. As regular caseload and it has gone up this year, and I'll talk about what's happening next year. And that's on a total general fund budget of about $104 billion. So you can see that, you know, there's just a massive problem in the revenue is just not there, and the expenditures continue to grow. California is in a fiscal emergency, and California is at a point now where it could be issuing IOUs as early as next month. This chart is very similar. I won't go with any great length. This copy of the Kaiser chart shows you about 7 million people. Again, they're preponderous expenditures on the disabled. California Medicaid program has already done a significant amount to be efficient. It's the second largest nationally in terms of dollars expended. It's more than twice the size of the next largest program in New York. So we have about twice the size of enrollees in California, and we don't spend as much as New York does. Nationally, it's the lowest per capita in spending per enrollee, and it covers the most optional benefits. So the state and federal taxpayers get a great benefit from the Medicaid program in California, and it's already done steps to save money. And what's important to note is that when you look at the expenditures, the non-elderly adults with disabilities are 25% of the people, but 61% of the expenditures. And then if you look, you can see the expenditures are very concentrated. So what this means is if you look at an environment where you've got to make major reductions in expenditures and your expenditures are very concentrated, they're going to affect the most medically fragile and needed people. There's no way of escaping that in a Medicaid environment. If you're going to, if you're going to have to make major reductions, you've got to reduce what you spend on vulnerable people, because that's where the money is. In the upcoming budget year, while the state's revenue is dramatically declining, the state Medicare Medicaid expenditures are anticipated to go up by slightly $1 billion state general fund. That's on top of a $14 billion spending base. So you can see that the increase just in workload with no changes is very dramatic. So the state is faced with, you know, dramatically dropping revenue and dramatically increasing expenditures of Medicaid. And I just add on, it's not just Medicaid, it's, you know, the TANF population is also growing. People on SSI are also growing. So there's a number of other factors. And then hospital inflation is also growing. So you've got this perfect storm of inability to, you know, cover your Medicaid budgets going on in California. California has already taken actions. It's reduced its provider rates by 10% July 1. Litigation on that, and but the rate reduction will continue either 5 or 1%, being changed to March 1. There'll be a lot of litigation on that. The state has implemented new status reporting for children. It's estimated that that will eventually take about 100,000 children off the Medicaid program in California. Hopefully most of those children will be ineligible. Made changes to what they subsidize for Medicare beneficiaries for Part B payments. And that's the stuff that's already done. In the pipeline for consideration is elimination of a number of optional benefits, most notably adult dental and optometry. Those are optional. Many states don't provide them. There's a lot of people who would argue that maintaining your mouth or your sight are not optional, but because they're optional federally, they're on the table because you can only cut what the federal government will allow you to cut. There's a reduction of coverage for working parents, and two reductions. One is a reduction of income level. The second, and more importantly, is the reduction in what's called an underemployed parent. For two-parent families, you have to be underemployed or unemployed, and that'll make many two-parent families ineligible for Medicaid in California. That affects eventually about 500,000 parents, initially 39,000 parents. A reduction in the income level for coverage of the seniors and people with disability, that affects about 60,000 disabled individuals. Restrictions of coverage for immigrants, and then further reductions in payments to the safety net providers, especially at a time when they're seeing increases in their cost. Just remark that the prior recession, Congress did and the President did provide economic relief. It saved the California Medicaid program. Because of that relief, California did not have to make eligibility cuts. Kept the program aligned and really allowed the state to bridge an economic crisis. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Stan. It's a sobering set of statistics. Can I include that? Move down that way. And now we turn to our final panelist, who's Margaret Hulbert. She's the Vice President for Strategic Resources and Public Policy for the United Way of Greater Cincinnati. She's responsible for developing these partnerships with other organizations to fund human services and community development and health for vulnerable populations in the Cincinnati area. She's seen close up what happens to folks who gain access to the health care they need and what happens to those who don't. Margaret, thanks very much for coming to share your story with us.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I work for the United Way of Greater Cincinnati, which is a fairly typical, large United Way. We work in four counties in southwestern Ohio and four counties in northern Kentucky, and work on public policy in two states. We invest about $50 million annually in health and human services, a broad array of health and human services for broad populations. We do not historically focus on health advocacy. We do now, and I want to tell you why. Historically, we have focused on early care and education issues, family financial stability, and programs that serve youth. But what we've found is that in all of our work and all of our investment, the underlying cause of so much of what is creating problems in all of those populations gets back to health. And while historically what we have funded in health has essentially been diseases, lung, cancer, and heart, we are now investing much more money in advocating for health care reform in the public sector. It is inescapable to us that the relationship between access to health and other ways of being healthy, well, financially stable, they are tied inextricably. There are three reasons we're working on this issue. Number one, it is a health issue, and we are concerned about the health of children and adults. In this country, we spend more money on health care, and we have worse health outcomes than almost any other developing nation. For us, as a product of the business community, and we are not only a funder, but we are a fundraiser, and we are still very closely tied with the business community in this country, it is a key customer group of ours. Healthcare costs are supplanting almost everything else for business as their number one concern, where it used to be access to market, taxation rates, any other number of things that businesses look at. The number one issue for them now is cost of healthcare. We see businesses going out of business, and we see businesses losing good employees because they can no longer provide healthcare. Nowadays, our businesses are even beginning to recognize that Medicaid and SCHIP are providing frequently the primary source of health care for their low-wage workers. We have some very unique projects now with our businesses, our supporting businesses, where we are actually going into those businesses and enrolling children of fully employed parents in the SCHIP program because they are at a wage where they cannot afford to purchase health insurance for their children. Businesses are also increasingly interested in buy-in programs for Medicaid and for multi-payer health systems in which they are a partner. The third reason we're interested in this, and probably the biggest and the one I'd like to speak to you about, is for us this is a major state budget issue. This not only affects health, it affects every other health and human services, every human service that a state does. It affects education, it affects higher education because of its relationship to state budgets. You heard about this from Robin, but this is a copy of the map provided by the Center of Budget and Policy Priorities that shows you that we now have 44 states that face budget shortfalls. That's a total of $350 billion. My two states, Kentucky and Ohio, are included in that, Ohio being one of the hardest hit. Since enacting our 08-09 biennial budget, which is $41 billion of general revenue funds over the biennium, we have already cut almost $2 billion of that $41 billion, and those cuts will not be enough to get us through next June. Cuts include the laying off of 25% of our staff in the Human Services Department, the closing of juvenile detention centers, slashing health and foster care programs, mental health programs, you name it. In my state, typically on a given any given day they will receive 7,500 calls to the Department of Jobs and Family Services, which is the Human Services Department. Last week they were averaging 80,000 calls per day. If you saw the news this morning, you know it's one of the states whose system crashed because it couldn't handle the volume of calls. With current projected revenues, Ohio will be short in the next two-year budget an additional $4 billion. So our situation sounds a great deal like California's. This gives you an idea of how Medicaid plays into the Ohio budget. It is the second largest amount of money in the Ohio budget. It is one of the biggest economic drivers. You've heard that already. But it's about more than health. Again, we fund a variety of things, from food security to senior services. And what we're seeing now, that almost every issue that we deal with, housing insecurity, debt, bankruptcy, food insecurity, children left unattended and unable to access child care, the more we look at each individual issue, the more we realize that underlying that in so many instances is a lack of health care coverage. Now, obviously, the foreclosure problem in this country is a complex and multifaceted thing, but long before we saw the number of foreclosures we do now because of our current fiscal situation, our largest driver of foreclosures in the state of Ohio were families who had lost health care coverage or who had major health care issues and had to forego paying rent or mortgage because they had to pay for health care. Why do we do health care advocacy now? There's numerous state and national studies that link health care and lack of health care to all the social ills that I just kind of enumerated. But we didn't need the studies to tell us that. United Way nationally, along with other partners, has what we call our 211 system. That, like 411 or 911, is a line that can be used by people who need to find assistance for almost anything. By the way, there is the Calling for 211 Act introduced by Senators Clinton and Burr, and we do need co-sponsors. So those of you who work for senators, please, this is a paid political announcement. It's the number is S211, surprise. But we have this incredible 211 system across the country that people call into for help and assistance. Those are the numbers from that. What I want to point out to you is, one, you should think about mental health and health in the same line. And so you'll see, given those numbers, the combination is the second largest number of calls. But what we know from running a local 211 is it isn't just those calls. What you see in terms of housing insecurity, income support, and food insecurity usually comes down to, not always but frequently, the fact that people don't have health care coverage. When we counsel them, what we find is that's why they can't afford the others. A local twist is we use our 211 number locally to do outreach for SCHIP. In 2 months last year, when we were doing outreach for SCHIP, what we found was we increased calls by 133 calls, and that was great and significant for our region. But general health care calls increased by 36% just from the advertising that there was someone who was willing to talk about health care coverage. Let's skip my next slide and just tell you, no matter what background we come from up here, we are coming to you asking for similar solutions. I have three, not too simple recommendations, but very important ones. Reauthorize SCHIP. It's effective, it's cost-effective, it's a great economic stimulator in and of itself. It needs to be improved, it has to have enrollment streamlined, we have to increase retention, and we do have to outreach to low-income families because they're hard to reach. FMAP is the best economic stimulator Ohio has seen. In 2003, it helped bring us back from the edge, and no other strategy, including tax cuts, has that same effect. The third thing we would like to see is comprehensive health care reform, and a great way to start is to look at the Medicaid model for both adults and children. Thank you.
Okay. Quite an array of presentations to consider as we go forward. Now it's your turn to get into this conversation. If you can fight your way to the microphones, they are right up here. Let me just take care of a couple of logistical things, if I can, before we start. There is a green question card in your packets. If you would like to fill it out and hold it up, someone will come by and bring it forward so that we can ask it from here. And there are a couple of things in your packets I want to call attention to. One of them, a flyer points out that as of 10 a.m. on Monday, you'll be able to watch a webcast of the briefing on kaisernetwork.org. There are also electronic versions of the materials in your packets, including some of the ones that were late arrivals and we weren't able to get into the packets. And finally, there is the ubiquitous blue evaluation form, which we would urge you to fill out so that we can make these briefings as valuable as they possibly can be from your point of view. So we are pleased to entertain your questions. We have a few that have been submitted in advance while we're waiting for you to screw up your courage and get to the microphone. Diane, do you want to start us off?
Well, the first question we have is, according to press accounts, in President-elect Obama's economic stimulus plan, nearly $80 billion is proposed to go to state Medicaid programs facing increased demand due to the rising unemployment. Given the discussion today, do the members of the panel think this is sufficient funding to support Medicaid programs already facing tight funding, or what is your alternative?
Was the question, is it sufficient?
Yes.
No.
Yeah. Just to give you a sense of the numbers, and it's got to be, you know, if California is facing $1 billion up alone in 1 year in cost and a $15 billion drop in revenue, it's a big gap to fill just if you look at the Medicaid portion, when Medicaid is the second to largest general fund part of the program of the state. I'm sorry.
The thing I would add is that relief for Medicaid should not be just a 12-month phenomenon, because the needs of Medicaid are going to lag behind any economic recovery. So whatever number Congress and the President in their infinite wisdom come up with, it has to be extended over a period which is longer than 12 months, and we would think 24 months would be reasonable.
If I could also, what we're seeing in Ohio with the economic downturn, and Ohio is particularly hard hit, quite frankly, it's no longer the typical state in the country. We anticipate by the end of March we will have a 9% unemployment rate, and it may even be higher because we lose 10,000 jobs in the next quarter. That's all that we know of right now. Because Medicaid is countercyclical, not only do we need help with an enriched rate to just deal with what's happening in the states, but the increased numbers will drive up that need significantly as people come off of work and need public assistance. Over 30% of the people who are currently on public assistance in Ohio have never been on public assistance before. And so that's going to drive the need much higher.
The second question relates to a complementary way of getting health insurance coverage, which is the COBRA program, where you can extend your employer-based coverage, but that's by paying 100% of the premiums. And this questioner notes that since COBRA premiums are so high, what are the alternatives or the implications for using Medicaid or other programs as a way to help subsidize coverage? Is there a link between COBRA and Medicaid that should be thought about? Is there a way in which COBRA is really putting additional pressure on Medicaid because it's so expensive?
We've had some experiments with COBRA buy-in programs. I mean, like a lot of states, when we first saw the impact of the HIV epidemic in the 80s, we actually started programs to buy into COBRA continuation benefits to subsidize people as a way of keeping them off of Medicaid, you know, that we thought it would be cost-effective. And it has worked. There's a small number of people every year for whom that works. But, you know, first of all, you have to have had a job that had insurance to take advantage of COBRA. That's problem number one. And some of these folks don't. They're losing employment where there was no benefit. And second of all, depending on where you worked, what you pay in COBRA is 102% of your last group premium. And that can be quite expensive. And whether that is really cost-effective as opposed to another way of providing coverage to folks, you know, it depends. I think states have done a lot of work, probably a lot more than we have in Connecticut, at looking at these ideas around premium assistance, where you use Medicaid to help people who are decliners choose to stay in employer packages. It can be effective. It is very complicated to administer under current federal rules.
Yeah, I'd add for California. California also buys in COBRA when it's cost effective. Often it's not, because often the COBRA expenditures are much more costly than just Medicaid alone. The limitation Medicaid has on COBRA that people really need to understand is that not everybody who loses their job is eligible for Medicaid. You've got to be categorically linked. And in California, at least, that means you've got to be a parent with a deprived child, which means if you're unemployed, you would be. But, you know, not everybody who's even a parent qualifies for Medicaid, and people who are childless don't qualify. So there's a big limitation on Medicaid.
We have a question that says, I'm new to Medicaid, but can you tell me what are optional and mandatory populations, and do you expect more states to cut optional populations? And the key question, who will provide these people services without Medicaid?
Okay, what do you do with it?
Well, federal law provides broad guidelines or laws for what states need to cover in terms of mandatory populations and benefits. So all children need to be covered at least up to 100% of the poverty level. All states across the country have really expanded beyond the minimum levels for coverage, particularly for children. And most states in the country have, all states in the country also cover what are really optional benefits, like prescription drugs is really an optional benefit. So the terms don't necessarily categorize that these things are not important, and it's very difficult for states to cut them, even if they're not mandatory.
Could I just add one thing there? I mean, I think it's been touched on before, but this is really Medicaid 101, so I apologize for everyone who was already aware of this, but a lot of people think that there's an income standard for Medicaid that if you're poor, you qualify, and that's simply not true. You could be a child at 100% of poverty and be eligible. You could be the mother of that child and be eligible, but if you're just a single person, a non-disabled single person, kid out of high school, kid out of college, kid coming back from Iraq, wandering around looking for work. He's not disabled, doesn't have children, dependent children. He's just a single person, unemployed. There is no way you're going to be eligible for the Medicaid program. There's no categorically needy standard that's going to apply to you. Now, in our state, like in a lot of states, we have state-funded programs for those folks. We have a general assistance program that provides kind of a Medicaid-lite version for those people for a period of time. But the idea that you're just because you're poor, you're on Medicaid is not true. Definitely not.
And people,
David, let me also ask you, though, you said you have state-funded programs for those people. Aren't those programs also in great jeopardy during economic times like this?
The state-funded programs are probably more in jeopardy because we don't get federal match. Now, through various devices that Medicaid directors don't like to talk about, we go back in rooms and we make this stuff up, we actually claim part of those costs under our hospital DISH program because the care that we're providing is state-funded, uncompensated care. When they go to a hospital inpatient, outpatient department, we manage to get federal revenue on that. That's getting harder and harder to do in the current regulatory environment. But, yes, a state-funded program is probably more vulnerable than Medicaid.
And all states have. State-funded programs.
Yeah, and due respect to the great state of Connecticut, not every state could have, has state-funded programs. In California, you really are, you know, if you become uninsured, not on Medicaid, you can go to the county programs, which vary by county, federally qualified health centers, or you know, you're responsible to pay on your own.
Let me just interject. One of the things that's kind of confusing is that there are both voluntary and mandatory and non-mandatory services and voluntary and mandatory populations. And I wonder if there's any further distinction that you want to draw about what's happening to the population lines.
During the last round, we eliminated coverage for optional services. So, for example, we got rid of chiropractic coverage. We eliminated coverage of podiatry, which was actually, I think, was a big mistake, given our long-term care population and their podiatries. But we no longer cover podiatry for adults. It's an optional service. But the list of optional services is fairly misleading. You know, when the federal government says you have a lot of flexibility because of these services are optional, pharmacy is an optional service. I don't think there's any Medicaid program or anybody would run a program other than Medicare. Medicare ran a program without pharmacy for a while, but they were on to something that we didn't know about. But pretty much everybody has to have a pharmacy benefit, even though technically it's an optional service. And there's some other examples I'm sure Stan can think of over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the optional populations... Actually, the Medicaid requirement for coverage of parents is very low. It's the 1996 welfare standard. And for the disabled, is all you have to cover is people who are on SSI, disabled and seniors. And as I mentioned, California has under consideration major rollbacks in the optional populations because of its budget problem, because, you know, California's also got optional benefits. When you look at severe budget cuts, optional benefits don't generate very much money. What really generates money is taking people off the program is what generates the savings. So if the financial crisis is allowed to continue, states are going to be, who have optional populations are going to be forced to do rollback and put, you know, thousands, if not millions, of people into the ranks of the uninsured.
Recognizing that many of the uninsured as well as Medicaid patients get care from community health centers, this questioner asks whether there should be money included in the stimulus for community health centers to help provide that as a source of care in addition to whatever Medicaid money is in the stimulus.
Well, community health centers play an important role in serving the uninsured population, and Medicaid plays an important role in funding community health centers. Community health centers have a unique rate relationship with Medicaid in that they receive a prospective rate, which many of our physicians would be envious of. So, yes, I think that the idea of expanding funding for community health centers plays a role, but community health centers can only do so much. I mean, they're there to deliver primary care, and I'm not knocking that. That's extremely important. But if you get primary care and someone discovers that you need a referral to a specialist, what happens? Everything can't be done within the walls of the FQHC.
I would add, in addition to community health centers, which are vital to Medicaid, The same issue applies to disproportionate share hospitals, and both groups are seeing the growing numbers of uncompensated care because of the uninsured. they get doubly hit if Medicaid's not supported, because Medicaid is the financial driver for both the community health centers and the disproportionate hospitals, at least in California.
Yes, we've got a question at the microphone.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Lipson. I'm with Mathematica Policy Research. We often used to say in previous economic crises that sometimes there lay an opportunity to do things that you might not have been able to do without those crises. And so my question is asked in the spirit of that. Many of the things, David, that you suggested would shift costs to the federal government. Some of the things that you suggested, Stan, that are being considered in California, again, go to the optional categories of eligibles and other optional benefits. But I'm wondering whether there may be some things that are currently required by federal law that if there were changes in federal law stimulated by the crisis, would give you at the state level some flexibility to reduce costs that you may not have had otherwise. And particularly here I'm thinking about the long-term care sector for the elderly and people with disabilities where most of the expenditures lie. Is there anything that you wish could be done given the extreme circumstances that we now find ourselves in?
Well, I think we both have a lengthy list. And you're correct in your observation that a lot of times it takes this kind of a crisis to really create tackling some problems that people have shied away from. I mean, it was mentioned earlier that during the last recession, a lot of states did, led by my colleague, Stan, did a lot of pretty aggressive things to control prescription drug costs. I think left to their, if things had just muddled along, we might not have had preferred drug lists and prior authorizations and mandatory generic substitutions and things that have really picked off a lot of low-lying fruit to control pharmacy costs. But you're right. I mean, there's other things that could change in the law that could deliver the same Medicaid benefit at less cost with greater quality and client satisfaction. One of the things we talked about, I touched on briefly, it is very complicated for Medicaid to look at any kind of premium subsidy program to provide coverage to people in the private sector to buy in. It's a concept that states struggle with, but the rules around how you have to go about doing it with a benchmark plan and actuarial equivalents, it's a full-time employment act for actuaries, basically, but it's not really benefiting people very much. So some more straightforward design of that could be another solution. In long-term care, you know, everybody talks about rebalancing. Where money follows the person, state. Everybody's trying to change their care delivery system away from institutional care to the community. But there are still basic premises about Medicaid eligibility that are greatly slanted towards favoring institutional care in terms of determination of eligibility for clients. You've got to be able, we find this in rolling out Money Follows the Person, where we have some people that have been in a nursing home for more than 6 months. We interview them. We set up a care plan to transition to the community. The good news is you can transition to the community. The bad news is you won't be eligible for Medicaid anymore. As long as that kind of dichotomy sort of stays there, you're not really getting at the kind of paradigm shift that I think we're all about in terms of rebalancing.
This question relates to yesterday. President-elect Obama talked extensively about health IT as one of the investments in an economic stimulus and infrastructure rebuilding project. The question here is, health IT is seen by many as a way to squeeze out costs and improve quality. What has Medicaid's experience been? Do EMRs work well? Is ERX working well? What can we expect from health IT for Medicaid?
The only thing I would add, I think it also, there's a tremendous opportunity, and the other thing I would love to see out of this process is a new and improved relationship between the federal government and the states. I think there's a lot that could be done in that area. And the things that can be done out of the opportunity aren't not going to solve the crisis. I want to be clear on that. The crisis should forge opportunity, but the crisis is so major that it won't do it alone.
On the health IT front, we have a big project going now with e-prescribing to try to get better connectivity and feedback between physicians and our Medicaid claims processing system as far as prescriptions is concerned. It's kind of one piece of trying to put a statewide EHR out there. It's just one piece, but we're starting with that. And that has a lot of potential. I think a lot of this stuff is very exciting. But I would caution people against thinking that you're going to sort of bit and bite your way out of the problem. I don't know that the elves really have the solution to what's going on with healthcare costs. I mean, all these are tools that can be beneficial, but I don't totally put my faith in technology.
Can I just crib from another question that came in on this same subject? Is it possible that by using electronic records to streamline, say, intake processes, you might actually increase costs by making them more efficient?
Enrolling
more people more quickly.
Well, I mean, it is true that to the extent that you move towards, say, an online application system in this age where people can go online and complete their applications, you are going to get at some of the backlog that resides in county and state offices relative to applications and perhaps speed up the time limits, the time that it takes to get someone onto the program. I think that we're so far away from that in our state right now, though. I mean, we're struggling with backlogs for case determinations that probably don't satisfy the current federal requirements. So I think we'd be far away from the point where we would be really sort of piling on the rolls, even if we updated.
Robin? Okay. Yes, go right ahead.
Stuart Gordon, Safety Net Hospitals for Pharmaceutical Access. David mentioned that the CHCs have been picking up a lot of the burden of the uninsured. Stan mentioned that the disproportionate share hospitals are sharing in that burden. My organization's had some inpatient legislation in for the last few years that would extend the 340B discount drug program to the inpatient population. I'd like to get your thoughts on how important an element that should be in dealing with the healthcare crisis.
And someone might want to explain what the 340D reference is.
Yeah, I think the 340B program is a terrific program, and I would support the concept of expanding it. I think the other thing that could be looked at is should Medicaid managed care plans be able to get the Medicaid drug rebates and be exempt from the Medicaid best price. There is a world of opportunity in Medicaid to do more savings through drug rebating. The Medicare plans are able to do drug rebates now as exempt from Medicaid best price. So it is time for the Medicaid plans to be able to do that also.
340B is a federal program where centers funded by the Public Health Service, including FQHCs, can get access to what's basically the government's best price in buying drugs, the price that the Department of Defense basically pays. You can't get any lower than that. And there are ways today for disproportionate share hospitals to get access to 340B pricing, but it's very difficult, and they have to pass some pretty impossible statistical tests. We had our largest disproportionate hospital, Yale New Haven, try to go through that, and despite the fact they're our largest provider of care to Medicaid and the uninsured, they weren't able to qualify for 340B because of something in the rules that just tripped them up. I agree with Stan. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I have to be a little cautious here. I come from the state that has the second highest number of pharmaceutical manufacturer headquarters next to our friends down the road in New Jersey, so I can't speak ill of the pharmaceutical industry, but clearly anything we can do to control the outlay of costs on prescription drugs, which has been happening for the last 5 or 6 years. States have gotten a lot smarter about how they've dealt with it, but there's still some new products emerging now that we're only really starting to feel the impact of, and you can talk about the good health benefits, but, you know, the biologics, the, you know, the $1,000 synergist injection that takes the place of the inhaler for asthma, getting to be more widely prescribed, things like that are continuing to be cost drivers in the program, and will, and as the whole genome revolution goes forward, you're going to see more and more of that.
This question relates to the history of assisting states during an economic downturn. In the last recession, when states got an increase in their FMAP or their federal share of Medicaid spending, one of the conditions was that they not reduce their eligibility levels beyond what those in effect when the legislation was passed. This question asks, what would be the impact of an eligibility maintenance of effort requirement this time? Would state Medicaid programs be able to continue their programs, and is this a tenable approach to be matched with an increase in the federal matching percentage?
I would say the answer is yes, it is tenable. I think that last time we got FMAP relief, I, at least from my experience, it played a vital role in sustaining eligibility in Medicaid programs in my state, in lots of states. I think that even with an FMAP increase for some temporary period of time, you are still likely to see increases in cost sharing. Even with the FMAP increase, people might still be eligible at the same levels, but there might be, where states don't have co-payments, you could see co-payments. Where there are no premiums, you could see premiums. I think that kind of thing is still possible, even with an FMAP relief, only because the whole is as great as it is.
Yeah, I would also point out that the last time the maintenance of effort level was very narrow. It just pertained to changing the eligibility level. You covered 100% or 85%. It didn't pertain to, could you increase cost sharing or other things. I think the fiscal reality, at least I'm aware of states, is that maintenance of efforts are fine and workable, but the funds have to be able to enable the state to meet the maintenance effort. You can't give a state a dime and say, keep your program the way it is. To give you an example, the maintenance of effort's got a tie to how much money is involved in the transaction.
Yes, Bob.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. The panel has focused on the state responsibilities for the Medicaid program, and it's a significant portion of the budget, like up to 20%. But we haven't talked at all about state opportunities and responsibilities for public health in general, which can address the kinds of causes of the health problems, as the speaker from the United Way mentioned. Instead of focusing on trying to ration the limited Medicaid dollar or shift those costs to the federal government, what activities can states undertake to address more efficiently and effectively the causes of health problems, not just for the Medicaid population, but for the total population? That's kind of the challenge that Deborah mentioned in saying, what's the crisis and what are the creative solutions for it? Instead of just looking for creative solutions within the Medicaid program, what are creative public health solutions that states ought to be taking now?
Well, there's a lot of them, and I think a lot of states have bridge that gap pretty effectively with public health measures. We're a universal immunization state in Connecticut. We have a very high rate of immunization compliance, both in our Medicaid program. We got very interested in blood lead. We have a lot of kids in inner cities that have high blood lead levels. We have a program now going where we actually go in and do lead mitigation in low-cost housing because, you know, again, it's the argument. We're going to treat these kids if they have toxicity from the lead. It's, it makes sense to start going after. We have, I think, the second oldest housing stock in the country, particularly in the inner cities near highways. So there's a lot of exposure of Medicaid children, very young children, to lead. So bridging out and to sort of looking at some of those non-traditional Medicaid activities that can sort of head off some of the consequences that you're going to be treating. I could give you other examples, but part of it is that there has to be flexibility from the federal government side to allow funds used in Medicaid to sort of make some of these kinds of modifications. And a lot of times the response comes back is, you know, that's not something that Medicaid can do. So you need to have support for preventive activities, environmental activities, weight control, smoking cessation, the whole array recognized as medical activities. Medicaid has traditionally had a sort of a narrow definition of what was medical, as opposed to, I think, where you're going, which is to say, let's think about how we could address some of these issues, like the development of type 2 diabetes in young children these days. You know, that's something we didn't see 20 years ago. It's going to be with us as a cost for a long time. We have a parent focus group that talks about issues with their kids, and I was talking to one of the moms about, well, you know, obesity and, you know, don't you think your kids should get more physical activity, trying to say that kind of stuff. And her response was, well, in my neighborhood, I don't let my kids out of the house because it's dangerous. There's too many gunshots. That's a sad reality. But that's some of the kinds of things that you have to get at somehow.
I have a very limited example of it, but I think, in truth, public health works best when it is in combination with Medicaid. We do a great deal of funding of home visitation for prenatal and very young children, and because in both of our states, and because of that, we do lead screening, we do vision, we do hearing, we even do social and emotional. Some of that is private dollars from us. But we have a very strong program in the state of Kentucky because whatever is Medicaid eligible is covered by Medicaid. In Ohio, it's not Medicaid eligible. So our program has essentially been disappearing because there aren't enough public health funds in either state to sustain it. But, you know, because Kentucky could make what it could Medicaid eligible, it has been able to sustain it with that and private dollars.
Yeah, tremendous opportunities in preventing and managing chronic diseases, tobacco, obesity, diabetes. What we found also, and I always feel like I'm a bringer of bad news, is these programs initially cost money. They save money in the long term. They cost money in the short term. And unfortunately, when you get to tight budgets, the policymakers, and they're not mandated, tend to not want to fund those because they're cutting everything else in the world. So I would add there needs to be funding for prevention activities. And a lot of it has to be done before people qualify for Medicaid, you know, really broad-based, which is what public health has been doing for years.
One other issue that we haven't really touched on, I think I was glad to hear the prevention component come in because as part of any larger, clearly you got to do that. I mean, if you do all of this and you don't address that, you haven't done anything, really. But workforce is a big issue. We haven't really mentioned it. None of us have mentioned it here. Up the road from where I live is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, who has probably done about as much as anybody's done about expanding coverage, but they're starting to see in the areas away from Boston, there's a real shortage of primary care providers for these people once they do become eligible for a program. We already have that in a more limited context in Medicaid in our state, probably in all the states, because providers are reluctant to participate in Medicaid for reimbursement and other reasons. But even when you craft an expansion program to bring in additional populations, if you don't somehow address that workforce issue, it's questionable about how much effective healthcare delivery you're really going to be providing, and I think primary care is really the key.
Yes. My name is Barbara Kornblau. I'm with Special Olympics. And one of the things that we would like to see, we're very concerned about increasing the level of activity. We also agree that a lot of people are concerned that their neighborhoods aren't safe. We'd like to see, as part of the economic stimulus package, fixing schools and fixing PE facilities so that they're accessible and usable. and encourage, you know, allow the community groups to use those. So older people can use them for exercise. Not older people can use them for exercise. Kids can use them and people with disabilities. Has there any thought gone into, have you all thought about anything like that?
Well, I agree with you. I think those are all good things, and President Obama should listen to you and sort of wherever you are. But the my response is that we have tried to work with schools around health programs, around outreach for Medicaid, particularly around special education issues, Medicaid coverage of services covered under IEPs. And one real problem, and I'm sure Stan has experienced this too, is that the attitude of the last 8 years has been very rigid about Medicaid's involvement with education. That somehow when Medicaid, I mean, we see Medicaid as, you know, being kind of enterprise-wide relative to education, prevention. It touches all these programs. But the outgoing administration has viewed Medicaid involvement in education with a great deal of suspicion, that it's somehow Medicaid's being asked to pay education's bills, and that some of the regs we're struggling with right now actually make that even harder. So I agree with you, but I think we have to have a kind of a culture change in the CMS folks if you're really going to be able to make that happen.
Not to that specific issue, but to the specific issue of culture change in CMS. One of the opportunities, and for those of you who deal with Medicaid a lot, this is old news, but for those who don't, and there are some of you here, enrollment issues are huge, particularly for me in the SCHIP population. We spend so much money re-enrolling children as they churn in and out of the system because parents are required to come in an obscene number of times to re-enroll their children. And these are low-income, struggling parents without transportation and who were really trying to get to go to work in jobs that don't permit them to take time off. But almost anything that we could do to make it easier to enroll, the hardest to enroll, either CMS doesn't by policy allow or it discourages states from allowing when states control. And so viewing it as a cost-saving measure to keep kids off, it doesn't make sense because for the rest of the population who's trying to enroll people for the healthcare system that's trying to deliver services to them, it becomes a double burden to re-enroll these kids. And frankly, we lose lots of them. So.
Have somebody at the microphone.
Hi, Doug Trapp, American Medical News. Robin mentioned past criticism of the old stimulus, the old FMAP increase is coming too late. Is the current one in danger of coming too late or not, you think?
You beat Diane reading your written question by about 10 seconds. So what do you think, folks, about the timing?
Yes.
No time like the present. states need it desperately now.
And many states are currently introducing their next budgets. February 2nd, we'll release ours. It's going to be a very different budget that will be released than it would have been had their stimulus package passed now. States have to balance their budgets. We'll begin the cuts before the package has been put in place.
Well, there's a question out here that maybe all of you would like to answer on in light of that. What are the arguments against the FMAP expansion? Does anyone? None, huh? Well, the arguments. Well,
the only one I've heard is it ought to not do it because it forces states to make hard decisions to reform their programs. That's the one I've heard. And my two responses to that is, first of all, states have been under pressure to reform their programs for a number of years. That's why I started off my discussion with California being the lowest per capita expenditure, that we've been cutting. And then the second response is that you can't creatively change your program to get out of this economic problem. There's not enough. The reforms that people talk about, you know, more co-pays, don't save as much money as states have to save now.
I've heard that the argument against it, that it's just not a, it's not shovel-ready jobs. That seems to be a slogan that's gotten very popular lately, that somehow it's not like immediate job incentivizing, and that there's other ways to spend money other than FMAP that would create employment. That may be true, but I think that clearly the FMAP maintains the integrity of a pretty important chunk of the healthcare system. And the healthcare system is a pretty large part of the economy in a lot of our states. So I don't know that even though it's not pouring bricks and mortar, it isn't in some way a stimulus.
Robin?
Not an argument against the FMAP, but one of the other benefits of the FMAP from the last time was that it was a quick way to get relief out to the states as opposed to the block grants that were provided that took some time to get out. The FMAP was already a system that was set up, so it was efficient and expedient in getting money out that the states desperately need, to get to David's point as well.
And one of the advantages of FMAP, I saw the block grant part of the stimulus, and some of it was brilliant and some of it was ridiculous. And Medicaid is a solid program, and FMAP strengthens a solid program. So.
There is in the materials a piece that quotes Bob Helms from AEI with what might be considered a criticism of the FMAP, although not of the FMAP increase, just of the FMAP. That is that the formula itself is either outdated or weighted too much toward, pardon me, rich states like Connecticut and California, relatively speaking.
Oh, don't listen to those people.
Weighted against states like California.
is, I guess, the real question that raises is this the time to look at the fairness of the FMAP formula?
Well, I think there's always criticisms that you can level about the FMAP formula, including the, you know, countercyclical nature of it, and all the way down to how you calculate what each state gets. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the way the FMAP calculated right now is perfect. I would caution against, you know, trying to talk about an FMAP expansion right now in the midst of revisiting the whole formula. Because the few times that I've been around when that's been done, becomes a real food fight amongst the states, where the southern states say, all you rich Yankees up north, you know, you're getting more than you really should get. And then the rich Yankees up north say, yeah, but look, we don't get much back from the dollars we pay in taxes. It all goes down to you. And then it, you know, you trying to get a consensus is pretty tough. It's difficult. So I think as a tactic, as a strategy, that could really forestall, really put off being able to get agreement on anything if you open that up right now.
David, there was one point you made earlier about the lag in the FMAP calculation, too. Maybe for this group it would be useful to explain the time delay and why increasing it now can help get over the fact that you're basing your FMAP on an earlier year.
Well, some states, not us, because we're rich Yankees from up north, some states have a variable FMAP which is adjusted based on their economic performance 2 years prior. So there are states now in the midst of a downturn, economic downturn, Ohio, places like that, who are actually, if nothing is done, are going to see their FMAP go down this year based on economic activity that happened 2 years ago. So just when you need it most, even if you didn't give people a stimulus, even if you just froze them, they'd be better off. But they're scheduled to actually be reduced on their match rate. That's really pouring salt in the wound.
And as I recall, the last time around, one of the provisions in the FMAP increase was giving states some flexibility to use either prior or coming FMAP rates if that were to their advantage. I haven't heard much discussion about that in the context of this stimulus package, but it's worth remembering.
Yeah, the other thing that happened last time, which I thought was very effective, is the FMAP relief was front-loaded. So if you looked at the, I think they had three tiers. The first time the state got the money was the highest rate. So the money came in very quick and very immediately, and then it dropped down, and it gave a very, very quick boost.
Just to follow up on the FMAP numbers, the reductions, I think the previous views that the Senate and the House considered in September and November did have a hold harmless provision that would have said if a state was scheduled for a reduction, they would not have that reduction, so that you would get that recognition that your unemployment rates were going up, which depleted your revenues and added to your shortfalls. One of the things that some Republican senators have said is that there should be a loan, and if this, you know, aid to states was a loan, it would force states to be more frugal and more judicious in their spending of that money. You know, it's hard to conceive of an increase in FMAP as a loan. I know you may not be state sort of constitutional or legislative scholars in that, but I know that there was a sheet handed out, and I just wanted to ask, what would be the problems if an FMAP increase was likely to be a loan?
It's hard to contemplate a loan in the form of FMAP because we do budgeting, balanced budget projections for 2 years. So you would have to figure into that your repayment schedule for your surplus FMAP on some sort of, you know, long-term basis. That makes my hair hurt to think about that. I don't know. Stan doesn't have any hair. But.
Yeah, you know, I think it would create enormous conflicts in states. Like California, for example, has a constitutional prohibition about borrowing money without a voter approval. So not sure how that would be constructed, but depending on how it was constructed, California might have to go to the ballot in order to even take the loan. I suspect California's not the only state that has that restriction. And I think it's not accurate, at least in the states I'm aware of, to say that the states are spending frugally or spending wildly, and they, you know, the states have been under enormous pressure to reduce their Medicaid budgets, and I'm not saying every state has, but most states have done the hard stuff. I think the Kaiser survey shows, and the states have got to look at, you know, the short term, how do I get through this financial crisis, and then how do you survive, because, you know, California is a state that actually has borrowed, and you end up spending an enormous amount of your general fund on debt service, and, you know, states just can't continue to borrow and borrow and borrow. And that would just be another borrowing.
If you also look at the position states are in right now, first of all, very few of them are flush. Most of them have repeated years of cuts, and many of them are going to have to borrow to pay unemployment compensation. And so, at what point do you stop doing that?
I guess the other thing that I would add to that is that if you don't think that states are frugal in the administration of their Medicaid agencies, call your local medical society and ask them what they think about Medicaid reimbursement, whether they think that they're being, you know, overly compensated for the services that, or your local hospital association, ask them. I think in most cases, we were very proud of the fact that with our last rate increase, we were able to raise physicians' rates from 47% to 57% of Medicare allowable amounts. We were, EPSDT, kids services were at 85%. And for maternity, OB, because that's such a huge area for us, where we pay like 120% of Medicare allowables. But generally speaking, we're a little more than half of what Medicare allowables would be for a comparable surgery office visit. We're probably one of the higher states at that. So,
well, we've had some sobering thoughts and some very insightful comments for you to chew on as with this issue makes its way through Congress and to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. And let me just take this opportunity to remind you that it would be very helpful if you would fill out the evaluation form as you leave. And take this opportunity to thank our friends at the Kaiser Commission for their real substantial role in helping us shape this briefing and recruit knowledgeable people from out of town so we aren't always giving you the same experts as we always do. Thank you for sticking with it through this sometimes fairly detailed and complicated issue, and ask you to join me in thanking the panelists for bringing us a message we needed to hear.
And we'll try over the course of 2009 to bring you a few more uplifting briefings. It's kind of hard to start this way, but this is the reality. Thank you.